From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, filling in while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Cy Coleman. He's one of the American musical theater's foremost composers. His hit songs include Hey Look Me Over and If They Could See Me Now. Also today, I talk with actress Rebecca Wells. She stars in her own show, Splitting Hairs, which is now touring nationally. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Four for All, the new album by the jazz quartet Sphere. And television critic David Bianculli gives us the lowdown on the new fall TV schedule. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is composer Cy Coleman. He's perhaps best known for his work on the Broadway stage, having written the scores for Sweet Charity, Barnum, Seesaw, Little Me, and On the 20th Century, which won him a Tony Award. His score for the movie version of Sweet Charity was nominated for an Oscar. Cy Coleman has also made more than a dozen albums and has received 13 Grammy Award nominations. Some of his hits include Witchcraft, The Best Is Yet to Come, Pass Me By. As if that weren't enough, he's also no stranger to television. He won 2 Emmy Awards for writing Shirley MacLaine's TV special, If They Could See Me Now. Sweet Charity was revived on Broadway in 1986, and this musical is about to go on a national tour. Cy Coleman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, I'm delighted to be here on Fresh Air, and it's refreshing.
I'm going to take you way back now to the beginning, to a song that was one of your hits, recorded by Tony Bennett, The Best Is Yet to Come. Is it true that this was written as an instrumental?
Yes, it was very true. As a matter of fact, I wrote it as an instrumental for myself. I had a little jazz trio. I used to play in some of the better clubs around, or some of the worser clubs around, as you like, whichever they happened to be at the time. And I wrote with Carolyn Lee at the time, and I used to complain bitterly about her. I said, I can't play an arpeggio without her putting a lyric to it. Well, in this, it was a very happy occasion for this one, though, and I was worried about The Best Is Yet to Come because I thought the intervals were hard to sing.
And
not an easy song, but evidently a lot of people picked up on it and they decided to do it. And I had answers and that sort of thing. So it was an interesting experiment. And, you know, when we first wrote it, we sent it to the publisher, sent it to Frank Sinatra. And he liked the song and he said, you know, it's too short. He said, you know, you've got to add more to it. And so we started off at the end of the song, you know, Come the Day You're Mine. Then we just picked it up, Come the Day You're Mine, I'm going to teach you to fly. So we wrote another whole chorus, a little interlude and that sort of thing. And he kept holding it. And finally, one day, I got a call from Tony Bennett. And Tony asked me if I had anything that resembled the Playboy theme, which is what I wrote years ago, you know. And I did write that, yes. And I said, yes, meaning the best is yet to come. And, of course, it didn't really resemble it at all, but I figured, oh, well, let me see. What's the difference, you know? Huh. And he liked the song, and we recorded it, and he was recording the next day. And I'll never forget that because we needed a fast arrangement made, and I was busy, and they found this arranger in New Jersey. And he came to the date and dropped off the suitcase and left. And it was all wrong.
Did you have to redo it then?
We had to redo it on the date. Oh. And I just practically redid the whole arrangement at the date. And that was, and it turned out to be a very good record.
Well, let's hear it.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine, I'm gonna teach you to fly. We've only tasted the wine. We're gonna drain a cup dry. Wait till your charms are ripe for these arms to surround. You think you've flown before, but you ain't left the ground. Wait till you're locked in my embrace. Wait till I draw you near. Wait till you see that sunshine place. Ain't nothing like it here. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine. Oh.
Tony Bennett singing "The Best Is Yet to Come," written by my guest composer Cy Coleman. You were...
I must say that it's wonderful to watch you listening to the music. You respond to every nuance. You really get into the music.
Well, he has such a smile in his voice when he's singing it, and the way the music sort of modulates in and out. It's delightful. I have to admit, I do love it. Did your parents love it, though, do you think, when you started composing pop songs? I mean, you were a concert pianist. You were on Carnegie Hall when you were a mere child, 6, 9.
Well, it was purely accidental. I mean, I don't think that they knew the difference between any kind of music. I mean, it could have played hillbilly music to classical music to jazz music. They really weren't aware of it. I just happened to play the music because my parents owned the building, and somebody skipped and left the piano because they couldn't get it out in the middle of the night.
Serendipitous.
Exactly. And that's what happened. I picked it up, and we had some friends send over a piano teacher, and I became all of a sudden the first child prodigy in the family.
Amazing. Is it true that your parents really didn't think you were successful until you started doing Wildcat with Lucille Ball?
Yes, exactly. They had no idea.
It was Lucy's notoriety.
It was Lucy that did it, you know. And they'd say, well, do you think we can get tickets to the television show? I mean, that was the extent. If I couldn't get them tickets to Lucy's television show, I was not a success.
Now, this was Wildcat. This was her Broadway debut. This mm-hmm. was your Broadway debut.
Yes.
Sounds like a situation kind of fraught with tension there, a little bit nerve-making, was it?
Oh, my. Do you know that when we waited for the first day, of course, before the first day, Carolyn Lee and myself had to write the songs for her. And here you have this enormous star coming off of television, and she's going to do her first Broadway show. And we're two newcomers. And we wrote other things, but we could not write that opening number. They said, what do you write for Lucille Ball at her first, when the audience is waiting for her to open up her mouth and sing? Now, I've got to tell you, we went through all kinds of things, and I like to say, you know, which is true, everything I wrote in the beginning sounded like Warmed Over Ethel Merman, and everything was kind of, you know, a little blary, trying too hard. And after about 5 or 6 weeks of constant effort, we wrote most of the score. We could not get that opening number. And finally, Carolyn turned to me one day, and she said, listen, she said, if it was not Lucille Ball, if it was just somebody who sang like Lucy, she said, you know, what would you write? And I said, if it was that simple, I'd write this. And I did the entire tune to Hey, Look Me Over. And
it worked.
She said, well, we didn't even know. We didn't even respond to it at the time. We thought, yeah, but we don't want to do something. I mean, we were trying too hard, too. We wanted to write something a little more intricate and sophisticated, too. And we kept writing the other things. And about 4 days later is when Carolyn called me up and said to me, you know that funny little tune you played? She said, well, how do you like this? She said, hey, look me over, lend me an ear, fresh out of clover, mortgaged up to here. And we laughed and said, nah. And we played it for the publisher, by the way, who absolutely saw, you know, it's like one of those old movies where he sees the cash register going, you know, and he said, and he jumped on it immediately. And of course, that was what Lucy jumped on too. You know, she loved it.
It's become a standard. I mean, it's been re-recorded by virtually everybody, including Teresa Brewer. I mean, I even used to sing it at auditions when I was a child. You know, it's sort of like the dance class, and you'd sing, "Hey, look me over."
They do it at the Changing of the Guard. I was surprised to hear it there, too, at Buckingham Palace.
Do they really?
Yes. Yes.
Do you think that's a compliment, then?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Really? Have you ever heard it in an elevator?
Oh, well, I always hear it in an elevator. You know, somebody asked me, somebody did ask me that question. They said, you know, as a musician, they said, well, what do you do when you hear that kind of gooey version of your songs and on an elevator? I answered, collect.
Is there any song... There's a story about Jerome Kern that there was the song, I think it was Bill, and he kept trying to put it into different shows. Do you have any songs on the shelf that you've been dying to use and haven't been able to use?
I have put a lot of songs from the shelf into shows. Would you like to know some?
Yes, I would, actually.
Let me see. Well, there was one. As a matter of fact, I was discovered here in Philadelphia. I was being interviewed. It was a very bright reporter. And he said to me, there's some incidental background music in Sweet Charity. He says, and it sounds very close to that song that Jenny Lind sings in Barnum. And I said, well, young man, I said, you have hit the jackpot. I said, it is the same song. What happened is... When we first wrote Sweet Charity, I wrote a ballet for Gwen Verdon, and they asked for it. And it was a beautiful dance, but it was just not placed right, and it didn't work. I mean, the dance worked, but it just felt like the wrong place for it. And it was this kind of like, you know, kind of a languid melody that went up and down. Mm-hmm. And I left it in there. I called it Gwen's Waltz, and I left it in there just as a kind of a remembrance of it. So I kept it as this little tribute to Gwen.
Interesting.
And then I forgot about it. And years later, you know, I was just playing through some things for Michael Stewart, and he said, I was going to write some operatic thing for Jenny Lind. He said, no, why don't we just do something that's not quiet? And I said, well, I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know why I remember that. I said, here's a piece of music I haven't used in years. And he just fell in love with a piece of music. And then after I'd put it in Barnum, I'd forgotten totally that it was a piece of underscoring in Sweet Charity, and this reporter picked right up on it.
Interesting. You wrote a song called To Be a Performer initially for Gypsy, which you didn't get to do. What happened?
Well, you know, we went and we auditioned. Carolyn Lee and I auditioned for Jerome Robbins. And I suppose he was, while he was looking at us, he was seeing Stephen Sondheim and Julie Stein. I mean, it's not on...
I never thought of composers having to audition for certain roles. I always thought they sort of began to write something and said, here, I've got this show.
We never stop auditioning. That's why, you know, when people say, you know, oh, I have to audition, we're not sympathetic because we never stop auditioning. I audition for directors. I audition for producers. I audition for backers. I audition for everyone on the street, you know. You, at the drop of a hat, you got to sit down and play your songs. It's part of the territory.
But you were offered MAME as a score to do?
No, Hello, Dolly.
Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. Why did you turn it down?
I didn't turn it down. Carolyn was having a bad mood that day.
Oh, so Carolyn turned it down.
Yeah, Carolyn, she just kept knitting through it. I don't know what she didn't like about it, but I liked it.
Do you orchestrate the show? Do you write arrangements?
And that's a question that a lot of people ask. You know, I lay out my orchestrations. The thing about with a show is this. It's not like doing a symphony. My work is needed in working with the actors and changing and rewriting, and I'm very involved with book, and I'm very involved with everything in the show. I think it's a luxury, and I think it's indulgent to sit there and put in the three scores that a composer does, because the rest of it is done by his farm dad anyway, just to say that he did it. Now, I can do that because what I do is when I get them, I reorchestrate them when I hear them. And I'm very fast when I hear that orchestrate. I've had many orchestrators crying, you know. That won't work. Pull out the woodwinds here. Let's put in the flute over here. And I've done that for years. I think it's just indulgent. And if I was doing, let's say, an opera or that sort of thing, well, you're not going to change it on the road. And you don't have to be up for it that much. I would probably sit down and orchestrate it. Like this, I just change it. And what I think I like to do is I like to give credit where credit is due. I know a lot of scores that are orchestrated by guys, not orchestrated by composers. And yet they've gone and they've done a little 8 bars and their name is on it. And if you look in the back of the program, you'll find out who orchestrated it.
There's a practice now of releasing songs from musicals before the musicals even open. Cats is one example, mm-hmm. when they released Memories. Do you think this is a good idea? Do we lose a sense of sort of surprise when we walk in the theater?
I love it.
You do?
Oh, I love it. I wish we'd have more of it. The trouble is, in England, you can do it. Over here, our record companies are so backward, they won't help you.
Oh, well, Barbara Streisand recorded Memories, which was a big hit here before the show.
I know that, but it was also a big hit in London already. What they could do is build up the hit, and then when it's a hit already, then they can do that like that. Very hard to get songs recorded out of shows. I mean, there's, as you know, with record companies right now, with the record artists write their own songs. So, and they're not really looking at Broadway as a source of material anymore. No, I love it. When people say it's a hummable score, what they mean is they've heard it on the radio for a month before. And, you know, if it's hummable when you walk and you haven't heard it on the radio before, it means that I've stolen it from somewhere.
You know. My guest is composer Cy Coleman. We're going to be talking about a show in which the reviews said that people walked out humming the scenery after a short break. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Cy Coleman, one of the foremost composers in American musical theater. He won a Tony Award for On the 20th Century, which the critics said that the people walked out humming the scenery. You must have been hurt by that.
Well, you know, I stopped getting hurt by that because what it is, I've had that with every show. There's always some critic who's looking to write a story as opposed to reviewing the show. And somebody, and all of a sudden, it's wonderful that he just discovered that cliche. I had the same critic. Do this, as a matter of fact, not that same critic. But I had a critic for Wildcat say there wasn't a song that's hummable in it.
And Hey, Look Me Over became,
A big scandal. And yes, and this very same critic, 1 year later, forgetting his review, said, now, if we had more scores like Wildcat. So the wonderful thing about writing a critic's column is that, you know, people forget. Mm. The only one that doesn't forget is the composer who you've jabbed.
Well, let's remember a little bit about On the 20th Century. We're going to hear one song. It's the song that closes the show. It's called Life is Like a Train.
Wasn't it Robert Fulton who said, life is like a train? No, it wasn't. He said, life is like a boat. Wasn't it Isaac Newton who said, life is like a train? No, it wasn't. He said, life is like an apple. Wasn't it Lord Chesterfield who said, life is like a train? No, it wasn't. He said, life is like a coat. Then who said it? Who said it? We did. We did. Ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. Life is like a train. Life is like a train. And aren't we lucky to be making the ride together? Life is like a train. Like a train, life is like a train, life is like a train, life is like a train, life is
not like an apple,
life is like a train, 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 life is like a T,
life is like an R, life is like an A, life is like an
I,
life is like an
N, life is like a train, life is not a boat.
Life is like a train. Life is not a boat. Life is like a train. 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 Life is like a train.
From On the 20th Century, a show composed by my guest, Cy Coleman. Very operatic, this. Quite a change from what you had been doing before.
Most fun. How do you like that? I found a lot of ways to say life is like a train.
You sure did. More ways than one. Did you want to do this? Did you want to do something different like opera at this point?
Well, it came out of the material, to be honest. What happened is that Betty and Adolph and I, Betty Comden and Adolph Green, were looking for a project to do. And they came up with 20th Century, and I was a little reticent. I thought, well, it's in the 30s, and it's very Busby Berkeley-ish, and I don't really want to sit down and do another 30s score. You know, I felt, let the historians do that. And we studied it, but the property was such a delightful property. I had to find a way. And in studying the movie, what I found was the characters were so flamboyant, so off the wall, and I thought, my God, they're really kind of like operatic. And I just loved it. And as soon as I discovered that, I started writing this comic opera. Well, it just flowed out of me. I can tell you, I have a house in Southampton. We were singing on the beach. I mean, it was just wonderful. The people would sit around and hear these tones coming out. And it came so fast that I discovered the cassette player. I don't know how I wrote before without the cassette player, because things were coming so fast, I never would have retained anything.
All right, you didn't have time to write it all down, note it
no,
all down.
No, yeah. I mean, it was just coming out of inspiration.
Yeah.
And everybody, as soon as I sat down to the piano, everybody dashed for their cassette player and onto the on button, play. Play and record. And it was a lot of fun to do on the 20th Century. I had a great time.
It's a fun show. Now you're here working on the national tour of Sweet Charity.
Right.
Have you updated it at all? From 1966 to 1986, did you feel the need that you had to sort of make the music more, I don't know, current?
Well, what we did is a lot of it stands up, holds up by itself, you know, but what it is that where we felt we could make changes, we did.
You did.
It was another opportunity to work at it. You know, we writers, you know, you never, you know, just give us a chance to go at our work, we'll just tear it apart.
Does it get easier the second time around?
Oh, sure, it's more fun, too.
Yeah, okay.
And, I mean, Bob Fosse did, directed, cut 20 minutes out of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Gave him an opportunity. I cut out one thing, and I'm the Bravest Individual was also updated. I gave it a kind of a little funkier, to use the term.
Mm.
I changed part of the sermon on the rhythm of life. Let me see what else. I was making little changes, you know, right throughout. I mean, little snips and
let's hear
tucks and all that sort of thing, you know.
Let's hear I'm the Bravest Individual. This is the new cast recording.
Yes, good.
When I get jittery, my knees buckle. Ice water tickles my spine. I bite my fingernails to the knuckle. Those teeth that chatter are mine. I'm trapped like a butterfly in a net. My mouth is dry and my hands are wet. I stop and light up a cigarette, cause fear hasn't licked me yet. Hey, you're unbeatable. Keep your cool, this case is treatable. I'm the bravest individual I have ever met. Yes, I'm the bravest individual I have ever met.
Why is it suddenly I can't swallow? Can't seem to focus an eye. Right now my stomach's an empty hollow. I think I'm going to die.
Just tell yourself that you're unbeatable. Calm down, Oscar, this is treatable. You're the bravest individual I have ever met. Tell me who's the bravest individual.
I'm the bravest individual.
You're the bravest.
No, you're the bravest.
Well, let's just say that we're the bravest.
We're the bravest individuals.
That's I'm the Bravest Individual from the new cast recording of Sweet Charity, which was revived on Broadway 1986 and is now about to go on a national tour and was composed by my guest, Cy Coleman. It's that middle bit you change, that kind of
that
funky...
Beat, you know, it's that bass line. Beat.
Is it true that Bob Fosse was reluctant to do this because he thought that the show was dated?
Well, Bob Fosse is not reluctant. Bob, first of all, loves it. He's worked enormously with it. He's put in a lot of time. Bob is reluctant to do anything.
Oh.
Bob is one of these people, you say to him, I'll play you a score, and I say, well, gosh, I don't know. You know, let me think about it. He backs into every show that he does. He backs into doing a revival. He does it because he knows, like I do, too. Once he gets involved, it's there. He is just totally into it. Mm. So it wasn't that that he felt that it was dated. It was just that that's Bobby's reluctance. Mm. As a matter of fact, you know, in the pre-Broadway tryout, Neil Simon came, and who wrote the book to this, and he came rushing backstage. He said, it's just as good today. You know, he came rushing back. And it was just wonderful. And I remember that night, too, because I did some movies, and Cary Grant was a fellow who brought me out to Hollywood. And
he did Father Goose, right?
Father Goose, score. Yeah. And I went with him and his wife. I took them to that opening in California for the pre-tryout. And he cried.
Mm-hmm.
He cried. He loved the show so much.
Well, welcome back, Sweet Charity. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Cy Coleman, for being our guest today.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
My guest has been the prolific composer Cy Coleman. He's written some of the most memorable songs on Broadway. If They Could See Me Now, Hey Look Me Over, and Big Spender are his. His musicals include Little Me, Barnum, On the 20th Century, Seesaw, and Sweet Charity. Sweet Charity is now touring nationally. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with author Avery Corman. He's written Oh God, Kramer vs. Kramer, and his new novel is called 50. So I hope you can join us.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those thumble bums to see for a fact the kind of top draw first-rate shums I attract. All I can say is, wow, we look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they could see me now, my little dusty group, traipsing round with me in dollar chicken coop, I'd hear those thrift shop cats say, brother, get her draped on a bedspread made of three kinds of fur. All I can say is, wow, wait till the riff and raff see just exactly how he signed his autograph. What a build up, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they could see me now, alone with Mr. B, who's waiting on me like he was a maitre d', I'd hear the buddies saying, crazy what gives, tonight she's living.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for the vacationing Terry Gross. Coming up, actress Rebecca Wells talks about her alter ego, hairdresser Loretta Sue Endless. Wells plays Endless in her one-woman show, Splitting Hairs. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Four for All, the new album by Sphere. And television critic David Bianculli tells us what will be new on TV this fall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Former Hitler deputy Rudolf Hess died today in a hospital in West Berlin. The 93-year-old Nazi was the last remaining inmate in Berlin's Spandau prison. More from UPI's Joseph Fleming.
Rudolf Hess was loyal to Adolf Hitler until the end of his long life. He called Hitler the greatest man Germany ever produced and said he regretted nothing he had done as a Nazi, as a loyal follower of Hitler. For his service to Hitler, Hess ended his life a prisoner. He was sentenced to life imprisonment in Four Power Spandau Prison in 1946 by the International Military Tribunal. He served out the sentence because the Soviet Union repeatedly vetoed Western proposals to grant him an amnesty. Hess said the Russians believed he made his madcap solo flight to Britain in May 1941 in an effort to make a separate peace with Britain to clear the way for the attack on Russia 6 weeks later. Joseph Fleming in Bonn.
Federal investigators continue their scrutiny of the charred wreckage of Northwest Airlines Flight 255. The plane crashed on takeoff last night from Detroit Metropolitan Airport. At least 152 people on board and two people on the ground were killed when the burning aircraft slammed into bridge traffic on Interstate 94. The National Transportation Safety Board retrieved the plane's flight recorders, which will be studied for clues to the cause of the crash. Alan Pollack is an NTSB investigator.
We will be looking into all aspects of the possibilities of this tragedy, and at this time it's much too early to speculate on any specific cause.
Flight 255 had arrived from Saginaw, Michigan, and was en route to Phoenix and Los Angeles. A Northwest spokesman denies suggestions that recent labor problems may have contributed to the disaster. The crash is the second worst in U.S. history and the worst ever at Detroit's Metropolitan Airport. Military authorities have imposed a news blackout on the movements of the next scheduled convoy through the Persian Gulf. Three loaded tankers were gathered today 2 miles off a loading pier at Kuwait's Al Ahmadi oil terminal. One shipping source said they appear to be ready to go. The question is when, and that will depend on the Americans being satisfied there are no mines. U.S. Navy mine-hunting helicopters staged a dress rehearsal today in preparation for the next escort mission. Officials of the largest mining company in South Africa met today with representatives of 300,000 striking miners. They are trying to reduce violence in the 8-day-old strike. But as the BBC's Graham Leach reports, neither side has been willing to give much.
The talks were described by Anglo-American's industrial relations chief, Mr. Bobby Godsall, as constructive. But there's clearly a wide gap remaining between the two sides. Anglo proposed that the mine hostels and the shafts should be allowed to function normally under the control of management. The NUM said this was not sufficient and proposed that all mine security units should be demobilized, withdrawn from the hostels and from all patrolling, and returned to barracks. In addition, said the NUM leader, Mr. Ramaphosa, the South African police should not be called into the compounds under any circumstances. All charges should be dropped against miners who'd been arrested. That way, he said, workers would know that Anglo was serious in denying collusion with the state. Mr. Ramaphosa went on, "We call upon the company to open the mine doors to the media so that its allegations could be put under the public spotlight and so that everybody can see from where the violence and intimidation really emanates."
Graham Leach in Johannesburg. The Reagan administration today predicted the nation's budget deficit will drop this year to $158 billion, down from last year's record, $220 billion. And a last-minute surge on Wall Street pushed the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 15 points today to set a new record close. The Dow finished above 2,700 for the first time. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic, Francis Davis, has a review of the new album by Sphere. This jazz quartet has been closely identified with the music of Thelonious Monk, but Francis says that with this new album, Four for All, Sphere has found its own voice.
That's a Thelonious Monk composition he originally recorded as Worry Later, before he renamed it San Francisco Holiday. The version you're hearing is by Sphere, a quartet featuring tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse, pianist Kenny Barron, bassist Buster Williams, and drummer Ben Riley. It's from Four for All, their new release on Verve Records. 4 years ago, Sphere debuted with an album that included nothing but Monk compositions. The band named itself after him. His full name was Thelonious Sphere Monk. Two members of the group, Charlie Rouse and Ben Riley, were former Monk sidemen. Rouse, in particular, was closely identified with Monk as a result of his long stay in Monk's quartet from 1959 to 1970. Their album was titled 4-in-1, after a Monk composition they played on it. It was both conservative and rash, loyal to Monk's material, but sovereign enough to avoid comparison to Monk's own interpretations. In retrospect, the album's one drawback was that it misrepresented Sphere as a Thelonious Monk ghost band, an image that's been difficult for Sphere to shake. Sphere intended its first album as an homage to Monk, not as a memorial to him. When the group's members gathered in the studio to record the album at 10 o'clock in the morning on February 17, 1982, they were unaware that Monk had died 2 hours earlier. They never intended to devote themselves exclusively to Monk. They merely intended to record some of his trickier pieces, the pieces that the jazz rank and file had long shied away from. On each of Sphere's subsequent albums, including the brand new Four for All, the band members' original compositions and arrangements of pop standards have outnumbered the items by Monk. From Four for All, this is Kenny Barron's composition, Lunacy. Thank you.
Lunacy from Four for All, the new release by Sphere. On face value, Four for All is a delightful album, but it's significant that the album's most delightful track is its one Thelonious Monk composition. The original compositions by band members Charlie Rouse, Kenny Barron, and Buster Williams are makeshift by comparison. This is not a problem unique to Sphere, and for listeners for whom improvised solos are all that really count, it might not be a problem at all. Fortunately, in this case, the improvised solos are outstanding, especially Charlie Rouse's. It's ironic that Rouse's membership in Sphere is gaining him recognition that eluded him during his years with Thelonious Monk. Maybe Rouse was underrated because he followed Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, and Johnny Griffin as the tenor saxophonist in Monk's quartet, pretty big shoes to fill. Or maybe it was that he immersed himself so deeply in Monk's music that it was impossible for some listeners to think of him as a commanding improviser in his own right. Or maybe it was just that Rouse's vitality and humor seemed lightweight in a period that favored John Coltrane's earnest solemnity. But finally, the most compelling explanation is that Rouse is one of those soloists who improve with age. He makes Sphere a joy to listen to, despite my misgivings about their repertoire.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Francis reviewed Four for All, the new album by Sphere. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Rebecca Wells. She's touring the country playing beautician Loretta Sue Endless in a one-woman show called Splitting Hairs. In the show, we first meet Loretta at Earlene's roller skating rink in Fishville, Louisiana. She's 14 years old and dreams of being a hairdresser. Loretta's dreams come true, and she goes to beauty school in New Orleans. In the final and third act, Loretta is married and the proud owner of her own salon. Rebecca Wells grew up on a farm in Louisiana in a strong storytelling family. I spoke with Rebecca Wells while she was performing Splitting Hairs in Philadelphia, and she told me about Loretta Sue Endless.
Loretta Sue Endless is a Louisiana beautician. She's from Vidalia, Louisiana, and she runs one of your finest garage beauty shops in the entire Southeast. She is a devotee of beauty. She loves doing hair. She's devoted to it. She's committed to it. And she sees the entire world through the lens of her commitment to hair.
Why did you choose Loretta's profession to be a beautician as opposed to, say, a waitress?
I think Loretta chose it for her. I dreamed the name Loretta Endless, not at all to sound esoteric, and it took me years to realize what she did. I think that she's a beautician and that I'm interested in her being a beautician because it seems like such a mundane, overlooked profession. And yet when you really look at the word beautician, it's all about a practitioner of beauty, someone who looks at beauty. And I'm very fascinated by Loretta's utter commitment and devotion to something as so seemingly small as the world of hair. It's like the I Ching says, in very tiny things is concentrated the preponderance of the great. So the more closely that she looks at the world of hair, the more dearly and the more clearly she sees the world around her. I'm also intrigued with the idea of beauty shops, especially garage beauty shops, because it means she's an entrepreneur and that's all hers.
Beauticians are also naturally loquacious.
Well, look at that. It's such a wonderful way to bear yourself. So when people are working on your hair or you're working on theirs.
Are these characters, the main character of Loretta and the other characters in her life, are they drawn from characters in your own background when you grew up in Louisiana?
Not specifically. I grew up in a wonderful storytelling background in Louisiana, and I haven't lived there in many years. But I'd say that the characters are a composite of the sounds that I grew up around.
In telling those stories, actually, your performance does remind me a little bit of telling a story to children, where if you're talking about the big bad wolf and then you change into the big bad wolf, it's a little bit like that. You have to switch characters, and is it more than just, say, a gesture or a change in accent?
Yes, it's very different because it's not storytelling. It is theater. It is acting. So what it is a willingness to let those different characters inhabit you, to move from Loretta to Bubba Rowland, who comes in, says, "Earlene, you know that it is against city ordinance to let niggers skate in this rink. I do not know what to think of you, what kind of woman you think you are. I knew you was an odd kind of woman, if I can call you a woman, but I never knowed you was a nigger lover." To switch straight from him to Earlene saying, "Bubba Rowland, I let the boy run the skates. You got a bone to pick, you pick it with me." To Loretta simply saying, "Earlene, aren't you just a little scared? I mean, to run him them skates." I think it's more a willingness to empty yourself up a little bit and let those characters fill you up. And when you do that, your body changes, your whole stance changes, as well as your voice. So it's not acting like those characters. It's really being those characters for a little while.
Where did you draw the line, or did you draw a line, between character and caricature? It would be very easy for Loretta to become sort of a cardboard character instead of a full-fledged woman that we begin to really empathize with.
Absolutely. It depends on the very, very most important thing is your own motive in doing this. I think if you work from love in a character and from respect, then you realize that there is a native wisdom in those characters, a wisdom that you yourself don't have. Loretta knows things that I don't know. She's far less cerebral. She's far less neurotic. She has answers to things that I haven't even asked questions for yet. So I begin with the idea of what is her vulnerability and where does it lead her? And what kind of bravery does this character have? And I begin from those questions and try to let her own humor come out, which is usually funnier than my own. And if you ask those kinds of questions, not how can I satirically make fun of a blue-collar, redneck beautician, which has been done 50,000 times, da-da-da-da-da, who cares? But ultimately, if you ask yourself, how can this wisdom come through? Then you stop short of commenting on the character.
And that wisdom does come through. She does turn out to be fairly politically profound. I mean, she does hear this lecture about nuclear war, and she realizes that it melts hair, and hair means something to her. So therefore, this issue begins to affect her. Do you think she represents those of us who perhaps don't pay any attention to political issues until it affects us directly?
Well, she's not political in a liberal wide sense in the least. It's simply that Loretta has discovered that doing hair is what she's meant to do in life. And when she realizes that a nuclear bomb would melt out human hair, it is not because she's against Reagan. It is not because she's hip and educated and political. It's simply because she says, "Honey, if that bomb was to drop, I would be out of a job."
She writes a letter to President Reagan to that effect, doesn't she?
She does. She says, "Dear President and Nancy Reagan, I do not know much about politics. I was forced to take civics over twice in high school, and I still don't understand how government works. I'm a beautician. I run my own shop. Beauty has been my career for almost 15 years, and I have been my own boss ever since my husband, Lonnie, and me turned our garage into my place of business. Now, you both have lovely hair for people your age. President, yours is thick and wavy, and Nancy, while yours is a little on the thin side, it is still very well kept. I speak as a beautician when I ask you to think, what would you look like as a bald couple? One nuclear bomb would melt off all your hair and kill my husband and most of my friends. I am a professional in the field of beauty, but I do not know any cures for radiation melted off hair. And as far as I know, no one else does either. The human body is not a styrofoam wig stand, and this planet is not a Pac-Man game. I, for one, will not think that you are a 90-pound weakling if you get rid of the 20-ton bomb. I would like to go on waking up and cooking and doing hair and loving my husband. If nothing else, please think of your looks. Yours very truly, Loretta Endless.
Where has this show been seen? Has it been seen in the South by your family?
No, it hasn't. It's never been seen in the South. I've toured it throughout all the Western states, and I've toured it through New York State, now here in Philadelphia. I've toured it all over Alaska. I've toured it in Eskimo villages and little bitty logging camps and fishing areas where you have to float plane in. But I've never toured it in the South, and I look forward to that.
Do you?
Absolutely.
Do you think they might be more critical of the audiences in the South?
I think they're more critical of anything that sounds Southern, because the South has been so much maligned because it's the least homogenized part of the country. It still has the most regional identity of any other place in the world, though I don't deny the regional identity of the other nine nations of North America. But it's the least homogenized, and it has been the most maligned. Southern crackers, we couldn't take Jimmy Carter because he had an accent, the whole business. And our whole sound is so Walter Cronkite'd out that the minute we hear dialect, we think mindless. So, of course, the South is much more sensitive to the idea of having someone do Southern. And I'm much more interested in a line of Flannery O'Connor looking at the wisdom of these backwards prophets than I am in turning another shake-and-bake commercial into something for the rest of the nation to just laugh at. You know, that really gets on my nerves. So, yes, they'd probably be overly sensitive, and I don't blame them.
Is there more that we could hear or see about Loretta? I feel as though there should be another chapter of Loretta's life, like maybe when she's about 60 years old and about to retire.
Well, Loretta, it just goes on all the time. I do public radio commentary in Seattle through the voice of Loretta Endless. I do it from the road and also from in town, and Loretta has so many things to talk about. And her story keeps unfolding, and I always get letters from people who say, is Loretta going to have a baby? And I got a letter from one woman who said, what if Loretta were in a bad car accident? You know, so I think that her life continues and that I look forward to writing more adventures for her, both for the stage and the page.
Rebecca Wells, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Actress Rebecca Wells is touring the country in her one-woman show called Splitting Hairs. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who is co-hosting the program, joins us from Washington. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Leanne. Today we're going to be talking about the plane crash in Detroit last night, and a lot of eyewitness accounts give us more details on how it went down. Still no word on exactly what the problem was. Also, problems with Northwest Airlines as a corporation. They've had a delicate merger with Republic Airlines over the last year and a half, and there have been some problems. Also, the South African black miners' strike enters its second week, and we look at the beginnings of the South African mining industry.
Anything of a little lighter nature?
Well, something that might surprise you. Korean popular music.
Well, thanks, John. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. Our television critic, David Bianculli, is back after a couple of intense weeks in Los Angeles, where he and more than 100 other critics previewed the new fall television season. David's a bit weary and bleary-eyed, but nonetheless, he has these thoughts on what the networks have lined up.
A few of the new fall shows haven't been filmed or edited yet, so it's a little bit early to give a complete overview of the upcoming TV season. But with about 75% of the key precincts reporting, it's safe to say that the 1987 fall lineup has its share of surprises, disappointments, and duds. Of the 22 shows premiering this fall as weekly series, the biggest surprise may turn out to be Frank's Place, a CBS sitcom that sounds like just another trendy comedy. It's set in a New Orleans restaurant and features Creole cooking and Zydeco music. It turns out to be a funny, subtle, refreshingly original show, with a talented cast, a fine script, beautiful photography, and no laugh track. More like a 30-minute movie than a TV sitcom. It stars Tim Reed, who used to play Venus Flytrap on WKRP in Cincinnati, as a guy who inherits a restaurant from his recently deceased father. The series is produced and written by Hugh Wilson, who created WKRP. His humor gives Frank's Place its delightfully offbeat edge. What other TV series has ever had a funeral home director as a regular character? The other shows most worth checking out include ABC's Hooperman, starring John Ritter as a cop who inherits an apartment building. Inheritances are big this season. Hooperman is co-created by Steve Bochco and Terry Louise Fisher, producers of L.A. Law. Then there's A Year in the Life, based on the recent NBC miniseries that was so impressive. It brings back the same cast and production team. Finally, there's Dabney Coleman as Slap Maxwell on ABC. The show isn't ready for preview yet, but based on the pilot script by Jay Tarsis, producer of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, it's going to be a lot of fun. Of the programs completed so far, the ones at the bottom of the barrel include Everything's Relative and Full House, two extended family sitcoms that aren't even worth describing, and CBS's Beauty and the Beast, a supposedly mature fantasy that is part comic book, part Harlequin romance, and all bad. The most disappointing, at least based on the episode shown to critics, is NBC's A Different World, the Lisa Bonet spinoff of The Cosby Show. A Different World could get a lot better, and from what I've seen, it almost has to. Then there are a lot of drama series that seem to be time-warped shows from 15 years ago. William Conrad in Jake and the Fat Man, Dennis Weaver in Buck James, shows that would have been right at home on the NBC mystery movie. A few other shows fall into the most unusual category, a category that could also be called most unlikely to succeed. There's Dolly Parton trying to revive the variety show for ABC, and a cop show, NBC's Private Eye, set in the post-war past. So, like Crime Story, it doesn't have to worry about Miranda warnings, safe sex, or hair mousse. But because Crime Story has already staked out that territory and hasn't exactly set the TV world on fire, it's hard to imagine Private Eye as a public hit. Most notable of all, though, is CBS's Tour of Duty, which will attempt to dramatize the Vietnam War during what used to be known as the Family Viewing Hour, 8 p.m. right opposite The Cosby Show. It's definitely the challenge of the season, not only because of the competition, but because of the difficulty of telling the story of Vietnam without the freedom to delve into drugs, profanity, or graphic violence. Tour of Duty does have two things going for it, though. It's the first of its kind, and novelty of any kind on TV is worth something. And it stars Terrence Knox, who used to be the rapist Dr. Peter White on St. Elsewhere. He's a good actor, and creates a likable, credible character as the platoon sergeant. The success of Oliver Stone's movie Platoon made a TV series about Vietnam inevitable. But if Tour of Duty fails miserably, either in the ratings or in execution, it'll be a long time before TV tries again. Frank's Place may be the best new show of the season, but Tour of Duty is easily the most important.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with John Peck, possibly the world's only rock and roll television critic whose reviews take the form of cartoons. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at what he calls the other Motown, black music from Detroit that wasn't part of the 60s Motown sound. And book critic John Leonard will review the new work by Nobel Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WSKG in Binghamton, New York. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.